Students too. Maud has her own issues with drinking, but her biggest problems are the ongoing affair she's pursued with Stephen, a married professor, and a column she's written for a campus paper mocking anti-abortion protesters at a nearby hospital. Just as Maud's writing grabs attention, her relationship with Stephen falls apart. She's killed in a car accident. The novel isn't halfway done by then. What follows isn't an easy morality play about abortion rhetoric or teacher-student relationships. Rather, Stone pursues a close study of how Maud's death has undone many of the certainties of those around her. The incident drives her father back to drinking and pondering past corruptions. An advisor recalls her own history as a protester and reconsiders her faith. And Stephen, who was arguing with a drunken Maud before her death, reckons with his own complicity. Stone gives his story the rough shape of a police procedural. Stephen is the main person of interest, which gives the prose some snap and avoids sodden, moralizing lectures. What emerges from Stone's crisp storytelling is a critique of tribalism of all sorts, religious, academic, police, that doesn't damn those institutions, but reveals how they work to protect their own interests at the expense of those of others. An unusual but poised mix of noir and town and gown novel, bolstered by Stone's well-honed observational skills.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 79 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Monday, November 9th, 2020. I'm Michael. Our big news today is regarding a vaccine from Pfizer. So we're just going to jump into that here in a couple of moments. First, we'll give you the numbers as we have them this Monday from the Odessa American. Editor's note, Ector County last updated COVID-19 numbers Friday afternoon. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 7,379. Ector County negative, 28,857 out of 36,691 tested, with 455 pending, 123 deaths. Recovered, 5,820. Active, 1,436. Midland County, 5,901 confirmed, 101 deaths. MISD's COVID dashboard still reads 330 total cases. And the Midland Memorial Hospital's COVID-19 dashboard still shows 47 out of 50 rooms dedicated to COVID-19 are occupied. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 1,273 cases in Texas compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 8th, 5,404 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 389 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 8th, 6,080 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 13 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 8th, 43 new deaths were recorded. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $40.59. That's up $3.45. Now let's move to this article from the Washington Post about this announcement this morning from Pfizer, which is probably helping that oil price, and it's also helping the stock market in general. Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine is more than 90% effective in first analysis, company reports, by Carolyn Y. Johnson. A front-runner coronavirus vaccine developed by drug giant Pfizer and German biotechnology firm BioNTech was more than 90% effective at protecting people compared with a placebo saline shot, according to an interim analysis by an independent data monitoring committee that met Sunday. The early look at the ongoing trial provides a decisive initial glimpse of the real-world performance of one of the four coronavirus vaccines in the last stages of testing in the United States. It is the strongest signal yet that the unprecedented quest to develop a vaccine that could help bring the pandemic to an end might succeed, breaking every scientific speed record. I would say it's a historical moment. Something like this has never happened before. First of all, the world was faced with such a terrible situation. The pandemic, and being able in such a short time to go through what usually takes many years, Katherine Janssen, head of vaccine research and development at Pfizer, said in an interview. Hearing that at the interim analysis, we are over 90% effective, it was almost stunning to hear. In Pfizer's 44,000-person trial, there have so far been 94 cases of COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus, in people who were not previously infected. Fewer than 9 of those cases were among people who received 2 shots of the vaccine, a strong signal of efficacy. The company's shares soared more than 13% in pre-market trading. The data is not yet published or peer-reviewed. The results are really quite good. I mean, extraordinary, said Anthony S. Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, adding that the results might bode well for a vaccine being developed by biotech firm Moderna and his institute that uses a similar technology, which gives you hope we might even have 2 vaccines. Fauci said he had spoken with Pfizer chief executive Albert Bourla about the results, but had not yet reviewed the individual data. The rapid surge of coronavirus infections in the cooler months, while devastating for the country, means the trial is rushing forward to completion faster than the company executives anticipated. With more people being exposed to the virus amid the surge, testing the vaccine becomes easier and faster. The race for a vaccine had become inextricably tied to election year politics, and for months, outside experts had worried that Pfizer's vaccine might be an October surprise, pushed prematurely through the regulatory process. In the end, the data arrived nearly a week after the election and shortly after the race was called for President-elect Joe Biden. President Trump, who had called Bourla to ask about the vaccine and previously accused regulators of a political hit job for slowing down a vaccine, celebrated the news. In all caps, stock market up big, vaccine coming soon. Report 90% effective. Such great news, Trump tweeted Monday morning. The data committee noted no serious safety concerns. Janssen said the side effect profile of the vaccine was similar to what was reported in an earlier study. That included pain at the injection site and fatigue, chills, and fever, which occurred more frequently in younger trial participants than in adults over age 65. Pfizer and BioNTech said they plan to submit an application for emergency authorization from the Food and Drug Administration after the third week of November, when they will have 2 months of safety follow-up data on half of the participants in their trial, along with data on their manufacturing process. The trial will continue until it reaches its endpoint of 164 cases of COVID-19, which Janssen said could take a few weeks. Vaccine development typically takes many years, even decades. But the coronavirus vaccines have been a rare success story in the response to the virus, able to move forward because of a flourishing of new vaccine technologies, a backbone of prior work on emerging pathogens, and a mentality that rarely exists in the world of vaccine development, of governments and companies willing to devote nearly unlimited resources to make sure that a vaccine succeeds. Outside experts said crucial details of the data need to be examined. How did the vaccine perform in high-risk populations, such as elderly people? Were the cases of disease mostly mild, or did the vaccine also prevent severe disease? Will the effectiveness hold up at this level as the trial moves toward completion? How long will protection last? What do detailed safety data show? Paul A. Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, said the data look encouraging. The trial's faster-than-expected progress to 94 cases, he said, was the upside of having a virus that's out of control. David Benkiser, a biostatistician at Emory University Rollins School of Public Health, said in an email that he was still digesting the news. "It looks to be an incredibly promising result," Benkiser wrote, noting that the two biggest questions are how long the effect lasts and how well the vaccine works to prevent severe cases of COVID-19. Both will still require more data to get a definitive answer. But for now, I think this is really good news. Regulators had set a far lower bar for the minimum performance of a vaccine, requiring it to be at least 50% effective. The FDA has also set forth a requirement for 5 severe cases of the disease in the placebo group. But Janssen said that to preserve the integrity of the trial, Pfizer scientists remain blind to the details of the cases at this time. The vaccine requires 2 doses, given 3 weeks apart. Pfizer and BioNTech are working around the clock to scale up production in hopes of having 50 million doses, enough for 25 million people to receive both shots by the end of the year, and 1.3 billion doses in 2021. The vaccine uses a new technology never before deployed in an approved medical product. Each injection contains lipid nanoparticles, fat bubbles, that surround a strip of genetic material called messenger RNA. The genetic material carries the blueprint for a distinctive spiky protein that studs the coronavirus surface. After being injected into a person's arm, the fat capsule delivers its payload to the body's cells, and the messenger RNA instructs those cells to build up the spike protein, effectively teaching the immune system how to recognize and block the coronavirus. Pfizer's early signal is encouraging not just for messenger RNA, Fauci said, but as a proof of concept that vaccine candidates that present the spike protein, the approach being pursued by essentially all the major candidates, can succeed. Pfizer, unlike its competitors, did not join Operation Warp Speed, the government initiative designed to erase the financial risk of vaccine and therapeutics development by providing funding to companies and helping coordinate the trials. Instead, Pfizer plowed $2 billion of its own money into the project and then struck a $1.95 billion contract with the U.S. government to provide 100 million doses, contingent on the vaccine being effective. Its trial initially had a more aggressive design than other late-stage studies in the United States, allowing earlier and more frequent peeks at the data. That raised concern from outside scientists that the company might seek authorization of its vaccine when there were only 32 cases among participants. The FDA shared those concerns, according to Janssen, and urged the company to wait to do its first data look until there were more cases. Pfizer scientists were initially concerned it would take too long to reach that milestone, particularly as it appeared the pandemic might be coming under control in late summer, thus depriving the study of potentially infected participants. But Pfizer scientists amended their protocol to wait to look at the data until they reached 62 cases as the virus began to surge, and they completed that paperwork last week. "We saw that huge upswing. We realized that maybe we should listen and come back to the suggestion of the FDA to have more cases," Jensen said. "It just shows you the enormous uptick right now of the pandemic, that it certainly took us by surprise, and how quickly it really went." Once the Independent Data Committee met Sunday, there were 94 cases in the trial, meaning the study is more than halfway done. This is a developing story. It will be updated. Now, I'm going to move into more of our traditional coronavirus briefs that we do generally at the beginning of the show, and then I'm going to read a few reactions to the study that was released today. The United States is on track to surpass 10 million coronavirus cases on Monday, just 10 days after hitting 9 million. At least 237,000 Americans have died of the coronavirus since February. More than 50 million cases of COVID-19 have been reported worldwide as countries hit frightening new records globally. As Pfizer's vaccine news emerged, the Dow Jones Industrial Average futures spiked more than 5.4% or 1,525 points. Vaccine news sends stay-at-home stocks, Zoom and Netflix, plummeting. Now, here are those short stories that are mainly reactions to the vaccine developments today. Fauci calls Pfizer's interim vaccine results extraordinary, by the Washington Post's Carolyn Y. Johnson. Dr. Anthony S. Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said Monday that the interim vaccine results posted by Pfizer and BioNTech were good news and could mean that the United States is on track to develop more than one successful vaccine. "The results are really quite good. I mean, extraordinary," said Fauci, adding that they may bode well for a vaccine being developed by biotech firm Moderna and his institute that uses a similar technology, which gives you hope we might have even two vaccines. Epidemiologists and researchers cautiously optimistic about Pfizer vaccine, by Letitia Beecham from the Washington Post. Some of the nation's top epidemiologists and infectious disease experts are applauding the news that Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine has shown more than 90% efficacy. But they also say they are waiting for more information, with new questions raised by the apparent success of the trials. Ashish K. Jha, dean of Brown University's School of Public Health, said on the Today Show Monday morning that he was expecting a vaccine to be 70% effective in the best circumstances. "This is better than I expected," he said. "It's still early, and it's going to take some time to get this vaccine out to the American people." Jha estimated that people like frontline workers could be vaccinated by the end of the year or early next year, while the rest of the American public could be looking at March through June, though Pfizer needs to release more data on how many doses it has, he said. Tom Frieden, former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said on Twitter that Pfizer's news is very encouraging, with some caveats, such as details on its efficacy against severe disease and among the elderly. "Only longer-term studies can determine longer-term efficacy and safety," Frieden said. "Furthermore, a complex administration program is needed," he said. "Even with a vaccine, we need a much stronger public health response," he said Monday. Peter Hotez, the doctor from Texas, the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, said via Twitter he's looking forward to seeing the efficacy and safety data in the coming weeks as challenges continue to swirl. Pfizer's company news release and Biden's coronavirus task force aren't the main story of the week, Hotez argued. "It's the humanitarian tragedy now unfolding across the middle part of our country as we head toward 200,000 new cases daily, 400,000 deaths by February 1st, he said. "The nation urgently needs a supreme allied commander to work with the red state governors who still believe COVID-19 is a hoax or overblown, and halt the surges on hospitals and ICUs and prevent mortality from skyrocketing." WHO chief cautions that vaccine will not fix the vulnerabilities exposed by the pandemic, by Rick Noack. The World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Monday that a vaccine is needed urgently to control the pandemic, but he cautioned that it will not fix the vulnerabilities at its roots. His remarks came as an interim analysis showed a front-runner coronavirus vaccine to be more than 90% effective, raising hopes that a vaccine may soon be available. Later in the day, he tweeted that the WHO welcomed the news from the developers Pfizer and BioNTech and said that the world is experiencing unprecedented scientific innovation and collaboration to end the pandemic. But a vaccine cannot address the global underinvestment in essential public health functions and resilient health systems, said Tedros, addressing the World Health Assembly, the agency's annual forum that resumed its session Monday after it was cut short in May. Tedros also congratulated President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris during his speech Monday, adding that we look forward to working with their administration very closely. The WHO was repeatedly criticized by President Trump, who vowed to cut funding to the agency. Other countries, including some U.S. allies, have acknowledged that the WHO should be overhauled, but they have argued that the United States needs to be a member of the agency to drive that process. Biden has vowed to reverse the U.S. withdrawal, but some worry the agency's future may still be fraught with difficulties. Taiwan, for instance, was not invited to the assembly that resumed Monday over objections from Beijing, despite the island's widely applauded response to the coronavirus. China considers the self-ruled island to be part of its territory. Now, a short article digging into the numbers that have been released today. The U.S. is close to recording its 10 millionth case of COVID-19 from CNN's Alta Spells. At least 9,968,015 COVID-19 cases have been diagnosed in the United States since the beginning of the global pandemic as of Sunday evening, killing at least 237,568 people, according to figures from Johns Hopkins University. Nationwide, 105,787 new cases and 455 new deaths were reported on Sunday. The total includes cases from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and other U.S. territories, as well as repatriated cases. Texas inches closer to 1 million cases. Texas is getting closer to reporting 1 million coronavirus cases as it announces 5,404 new cases Sunday, according to Texas Health and Human Services. So far, there have been 956,234 total cases reported in the state since the pandemic began. The state reported 43 new deaths, bringing their total of coronavirus deaths to 18,743. There are currently 6,080 people in the state's hospital with the disease. Hospitals have 1,000 ICU beds available and more than 7,000 ventilators. New study finds hydroxychloroquine doesn't work for patients hospitalized with COVID-19, from CNN Health's Leanna Falk. Hydroxychloroquine does not work on patients hospitalized with COVID-19, according to research published Monday in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. It's the latest of several studies to find the anti-malarial does not work against the coronavirus. These findings do not support the use of hydroxychloroquine for treatment of COVID-19 among hospitalized adults, wrote Dr. Wesley Self of the Vanderbilt University Medical Center Department of Emergency Medicine and colleagues. The randomized trial involved 479 COVID-19 patients at 34 U.S. hospitals with respiratory illness. Some received hydroxychloroquine and some received a placebo. The results found strong evidence that hydroxychloroquine is not beneficial for adults hospitalized with COVID-19 and no significant difference between the hydroxychloroquine and the placebo groups. The trial had several limitations, including that it only included hospitalized adults and only one dosage level of hydroxychloroquine. It did not consider whether patients used other therapies, such as azithromycin, zinc, or remdesivir. In a corresponding JAMA editorial, Dr. Michael Sag, a researcher with the Department of Medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, noted President Donald Trump's early support of hydroxychloroquine as a COVID-19 treatment and wrote that politicization was an important factor in promoting use of the drug. The clear, unambiguous, and compelling lesson from the hydroxychloroquine study for the medical community and the public is that science and politics do not mix, SAG wrote. The number of articles in the peer-reviewed literature over the last several months that have consistently and convincingly demonstrated the lack of efficacy of a highly hyped cure for COVID-19 represent the consequence of the irresponsible infusion of politics into the world of scientific evidence and discourse. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration granted an emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine on March 28th after a big push from Trump and his administration, but revoked it on June 15th. HUD Secretary Ben Carson tests positive for the coronavirus by Paulina Ferozzi and Suing Min Kim. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson has tested positive for the coronavirus, a HUD spokesman confirmed. Carson, who tested positive Monday morning, was at the White House on Tuesday for an election night event, as was White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who has also tested positive for the virus. Carson was around senior administration officials and other cabinet members during the event. Carson is a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. The diagnosis comes days after news of a fresh wave of coronavirus infections at the White House, with Meadows and five other Trump aides having received positive test results in the time around Election Day. President-elect Biden announces coronavirus task force made up of physicians and health experts by the Washington Post's Yasmin Abutaleb. President-elect Joe Biden on Monday announced the members of his coronavirus task force, a group made up entirely of doctors and health experts, a move that signals the science-based approach Biden has vowed in seeking to bring the raging pandemic under control. Biden's task force will have three co-chairs, Vivek H. Murthy, Surgeon General during the Obama administration, David Kessler, Food and Drug Administration Commissioner under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and Marcella Nunez-Smith, Associate Dean for Health Equity Research at the Yale School of Medicine. Murthy and Kessler have briefed Biden for months on the pandemic. Biden will inherit the worst crisis since the Great Depression, made more difficult by President Trump's refusal to concede the election and commit to a peaceful transition of power. The Trump administration has not put forward national plans for testing, contact tracing, and resolving shortages in personal protective equipment that hospitals and healthcare facilities are experiencing again as the nation enters its third surge of the virus. And with that, we'll wrap up our coronavirus update for this Monday. Coming up next, we'll bring you a health magazine to take us up until 2 o'clock, at which time we'll bring you national news from USA Today. And then at 3 o'clock, our local news broadcast. Here are some of the articles our volunteers are reading this morning. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, rig count advances for 8th straight week. Election chief says number of voters assigned to wrong district will grow. MISD teachers protest to keep virtual Fridays. Analysts say Senate could act as check on Biden on energy matters. And getting students back on campus is Dixon's priority. From the Odessa American, UTPB student earns National Gold Award. ECISD to get rapid COVID tests. Lawyer eschews corporate mold. Odessa personal injury attorney lets clients make all the important decisions. And Jesus House event to give to the needy. Those articles and more are coming up at 3 o'clock, and then we'll bring you more news at 6 from the Wall Street Journal. As always, thank you for being with us today. We'll return with our broadcast at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Meanwhile, be well and have a great day.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 81 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Hello, I am Allison Ramsey, and this is Health Magazine. Today, I'll be reading from health.com. The first story is 7 Benefits of Pumpkin Seeds, According to Nutritionists. These nutrition facts will make you want to carve a jack-o'-lantern. By Cynthia Sass, MPH, RD. Updated on November 3rd, 2020. Each product we feature has been independently selected and reviewed by our editorial team. If you make a purchase using the links included, we may earn commission. I love everything about pumpkins, including pumpkin seeds. As a kid, I loved tearing them out of our carved pumpkins at Halloween and cleaning them to roast in the oven. But these days, it's easy to find raw, sprouted, and roasted pumpkin seeds year-round. Health benefits of pumpkin seeds. A 1-ounce portion, roughly a quarter cup, of raw pumpkin seeds provides about 150 calories, 15 grams of healthful fats, just a few grams of carbs, and an impressive 8 to 10 grams of plant protein. They're also nutrient-packed and health-protective. Here are 6 key pumpkin seed perks and some simple ways to incorporate them into your meals and snacks. Pumpkin seeds are high in magnesium and other minerals. Raw pumpkin seeds, also known as pepitas, are a good source of magnesium, manganese, iron, zinc, and copper. Magnesium helps improve mood and sleep, while manganese plays a role in collagen production and promotes skin and bone health. Iron and copper are involved with energy production, and iron also helps transport oxygen to our cells. Zinc supports immunity, skin health, and vision. Eating just 1 serving of pumpkin seeds can supply 14 to 42% of the daily target for these essential nutrients. Pumpkin seeds are high in antioxidants. In addition to minerals, these mighty seeds are also packed with cell-protective antioxidants, including carotenoids and vitamin E. In addition to reducing inflammation, antioxidants help fend off premature aging and chronic diseases. Pumpkin seeds are full of beneficial fats. Pumpkin seeds are one of the best sources of plant-based omega-3 fatty acids called alpha-linolenic acid, or ALA. Only a small fraction of ALA gets converted into the important DHA and EPA omega-3s, which are found in fatty fish like salmon. However, the benefits of ALA include heart disease protection, reduced risk of artery hardening, and anti-inflammation. Pumpkin seeds help control blood sugar. On top of being low in carbs and a good source of plant protein, research suggests that eating pumpkin seeds help protect against type 2 diabetes or reduce its complications in other ways, such as improving insulin regulation and protecting organs against the consequences of diabetes. Pumpkin seeds improve the immune system. In addition to the zinc and iron in pumpkin seeds, which are both vital for immune function, pumpkin seeds possess antifungal and antiviral properties. Pumpkin seeds are also not a common trigger of allergies and intolerances. Pumpkin seeds may improve sperm quality. Research shows that both pumpkin seeds and pumpkin seed oil help to protect prostate health. The seed's zinc contents may also support male fertility, as low zinc levels have been tied to reduced sperm quality. Pumpkin seed oil may benefit hair growth. Yes, even pumpkin seed oil has its benefits, like treating male pattern baldness and promoting hair growth. According to a 2019 study in Avicenna Journal of Phytomedicine, the fatty acids, vitamin E, and phytoestrogens found in pumpkin seed oil can help boost hair growth when applied to the scalp. How to eat more pumpkin seeds. You can sprinkle pumpkin seeds on just about anything, from oatmeal or overnight oats to garden salads, cooked veggies, stir fries, soups, whole grain dishes, tacos, and of course desserts. Pumpkin seed butter can also be whipped into smoothies, swirled into yogurt, drizzled over fruit, or used as the base for energy bars or balls. A few of my favorite brands of ready-to-eat pumpkin seeds include Super Seeds, which come in a variety of flavors like maple sugar and sea salt, and Coco Joe, and Go Raw Sprouted Pumpkin Seeds. Cynthia Sass, MPHRD, is Health's Contributing Nutrition Editor, a New York Times bestselling author, and a private practice performance nutritionist who has consulted for 5 professional sports teams. That story was 7 Benefits of Pumpkin Seeds According to Nutritionists by Cynthia Sass, MPHRD, updated on November 3rd, 2020. The next story is COVID-19 testing. Here's how often you should really be doing it. It's Necessary to Ending the Pandemic by Ashley Mateo, posted on November 2nd, 2020. In March, while suffering from cold-like symptoms and a fever, I likely needed a COVID-19 test. But since I hadn't been to China, I was told I couldn't get one. 8 months later, it seems like everyone I know is getting COVID-19 tests, whether they have symptoms or not, before seeing family, to justify traveling, or just to be aware of their status. It's easy to understand. People are scared. 48% of Americans said they're anxious about the possibility of getting coronavirus, COVID-19, and even more, 62%, said they're anxious about the possibility of family and loved ones getting coronavirus, according to a poll conducted by the American Psychiatric Association. Routine screening seems to be a way to reassure yourself and others that you're following the rules and, in some cases, that it's okay if you break them. But the U.S. is currently in the midst of a third wave of the pandemic. The nation set a new single-day record on October 29 with 83,757 new cases. Considering the fact that the spring saw widespread shortages in testing supplies, could routine testing overtax the medical system? The availability of testing does seem to have improved, says Suzanne Pham, MD, Medical Director of the COVID-19 Response Team at Weiss Memorial Hospital in Chicago. Whether or not supplies will last as long as they need to, I do have worries about that. Despite steps the U.S. has taken to better prepare itself for another onslaught of cases, hospitals, labs, and medical centers are still not at a point where they can handle unlimited testing. If someone's at an increased risk for severe illness or has close contact with someone who's at an increased risk for severe illness, I think getting tested regularly is smart, says Dr. Pham. For those who are merely worried but don't have a history of contact with anyone of concern and aren't at an increased risk of severe illness, regular testing could strain the system and may take away the ability to test those who truly need it. Even though there have been significant improvements in testing, it's not a perfect screening method either. Rapid tests, which are becoming more widely available, use the same technology as polymerase chain reaction, PCR tests, which directly detect the presence of an antigen, something that induces an immune response, rather than the presence of the antibodies. Rapid tests, however, aren't quite as sensitive as the PCR tests, so they may not detect the virus at a lower load. The benefit of a rapid test is, if you're positive, you know pretty quickly, says Dr. Pham. The downside of a rapid test is, if you're negative, you don't know for sure if you're truly negative. So much depends on the timing of your test, Dr. Pham adds. Because it takes a certain amount of time for the virus to replicate enough to even be detected. If you were exposed an hour prior to getting tested, well, it's highly unlikely that test is going to pick it up. It may take 3, 4, or 5 days for you to test positive, she explains. And during all that time, you could be infecting others. That's not to say doctors, including Dr. Pham, aren't all for more testing. You can't manage what you can't measure, and we need massive full-scale development and deployment of COVID-19 testing. Joseph Allen, director of the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard, an assistant professor of exposure assessment science at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and a member of the Lancet COVID-19 Commission, tells Health. In an ideal scenario, routine testing could not only catch potentially asymptomatic cases, it could also catch cases before symptoms develop, helping to slow the spread. Eventually, testing will be normalized, and getting a COVID-19 test may be as simple as, say, getting a pregnancy test. The accuracy of these tests is getting better each week, and the arrival of low-cost antigen-based rapid tests that you can self-administer and get results from within minutes could fundamentally shift the course of the pandemic, says Allen. But the rollout of those tests takes time. Abbott Laboratories, for example, is shipping 100 million rapid COVID-19 tests for free. That sounds like a lot, but it only means every third person in the country gets a test once a year, says Allen. We need a massive upscaling. Even then, the problem with casual testing comes when people rely solely on it. We have evidence of that in a high-profile, spectacular way at the White House, says Allen. They had a testing-only strategy and ignored all other controls. No social distance, no mask wearing. So it was never a question of if infection would happen at the White House, it was just a matter of when. Regular testing is only a part of COVID-19 prevention. We still have to do everything else. Maintain a small social network, stay socially distanced, wear masks, and wash our hands, says Allen. When testing is done right, with those controls in place, it can work really well. Just look at the major sports leagues. The NBA, which resumed its season in July, reported no COVID-19 cases during the 90-plus days players, coaches, and staffers were sequestered in a protective bubble in Florida to reduce exposure risk. Everyone received COVID-19 tests at least every other day for the week before joining the bubble. After that, players who left the bubble were required to be tested each day they were gone if they left for less than a week, or at least the 7 days before returning to the bubble if gone longer. But if you're not getting tested regularly, that's okay. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, still maintains that not everyone needs to be tested. Those who should get tested, they say, are people who have symptoms of COVID-19 or people who have had close contact within 6 feet for a total of 15 minutes or more with someone with confirmed COVID-19. As long as you follow those safety guidelines, there's no need to get tested weekly. We know these other control strategies work, says Allen. It's about sticking to the basics. The information in this story is accurate as of press time. However, as the situation surrounding COVID-19 continues to evolve, it's possible that some data have changed since publication. While Health is trying to keep our stories as up-to-date as possible, we also encourage readers to stay informed on news and recommendations for their own communities by using the CDC, WHO, and their local public health departments as resources. That story was COVID-19 Testing. Here's How Often You Should Really Be Doing It by Ashley Mateo, posted on November 2nd, 2020. The next story is I Quit Dieting for Good, but escaping diet culture was a whole other factor. No one ever told me that even when you give up your relationship with diet culture, the rest of the world doesn't give up theirs. By Olivia Munter, posted on November 3rd, 2020. When I quit dieting, I thought I knew what the most difficult parts of the process would be. I had accepted that giving up food restriction, calorie counting, and obsessive exercise would be difficult. But ultimately, that wasn't what really scared me about the process. What terrified me was becoming okay with living in a larger body, with loosening my grip on the impossible beauty standards that I had worshipped for so long. After all, when you spend a solid decade of your life trying to whittle your current body into something better, accepting your body as it is feels like failure, like giving up on yourself. Still, in spite of all my hesitations, I did the work. I replaced fantasies of being thin with fantasies of being on the other side of dieting. I pictured days when I wouldn't feel anxious about accepting or declining a breadbasket before dinner, of when I could drink my coffee with cream, and even, gasp, sugar, without feeling guilty, of when I was free of an endless cycle of depriving myself of food and then binging on it later. I set my mind on this new balanced version of myself, and I did the painful work of getting there and replacing old toxic habits with new ones. Years later, I can confidently say I finally have a healthy, balanced relationship with food and my body. But I can also say that all those preconceived notions of what would be the hardest part of the process were wrong, and not for the reasons you might think. Because in all the months of no longer religiously recording my weight, fixating on a number on a scale, or giving up entire food groups for 6 months at a time, no one ever told me that even when you give up your relationship with diet culture, the rest of the world doesn't give up theirs, not even a little bit. Turns out, when you start actively pushing back against how diet culture exists within yourself, you start to become hyper-aware of how it seeps into every other aspect of your life too. You notice it when a distant family member talks about how much weight they have to lose before a big life event. You pick up on it when your parents rave about the latest, greatest diet trend they're trying. Your brain registers when a friend has to preface every meal by saying just how long it has been since they've eaten carbs or sugar or dairy. You notice it when a stranger comments on the exact nutritional breakdown of food. Oh my God, have you ever seen how many calories one of those has? You see it in the before and after weight loss montages from that person you went to high school with, always attached to the shiniest lifestyle change program. It goes on, and it's everywhere. Unfortunately, even when you've managed to address your own BS when it comes to dieting, It doesn't mean that you are suddenly immune to everyone else's. And as difficult as it can be to personally accept that yo-yo dieting, restriction, and binging are toxic and dangerous, it can be even more difficult to tell other people that too. I quickly learned that being around family meant comments about dieting and weight, not because my family and friends are any different from anyone else's, but because they exist in the same world I do. The one that says, if you are thinner, you are more worthy of a job, a medical diagnosis, or a partner. On a recent family trip, these types of comments came up again, and as confident as I was in my own opinions of dieting, of the damage it had done to me over the years, I felt inexplicably frozen. Even though I could write dozens of articles or Instagram captions about how quitting dieting has benefited my physical and mental health, something about looking my family in the eye and saying, hey, could we talk about something else other than your dieting? Can we not discuss calories? Can we not talk about food restriction? Terrifying bordered on impossible. Still, there was no getting around it. Their comments worked their way under my skin, into my brain. I watched people practically equating weight loss with achieving world peace, and sickly, I craved that approval too. According to Maria Sobara Mora, RD, an eating disorder and exercise compulsion expert, this reaction was normal. Mora explains that for those who are in recovery for eating disorders or have experienced disordered eating, something that she tells me is no different than dieting, since dieting asks us to eat in a restrictive or extreme way, commentary about food can be loaded with triggers. So much of our work as dietitians that specialize in eating disorder recovery is to try to normalize, legalize, and neutralize food, Mora tells Health. Hearing comments like, that food is so fattening, or I don't eat carbs, or I'm going gluten-free, is beyond confusing for those trying to work on their relationship with food. Food is not the villain here. Creating strong poles of good and bad foods make it difficult for those in recovery to find the middle. To push against conversations about food, dieting, and weight, Mora suggests shifting your perspective to totally focus on the progress you've made in your recovery and how valuable that is. It may seem alluring or attractive to try intermittent fasting after a colleague tells you how much weight they lost, Mora says, echoing so many of my own thoughts in similar situations. It may feel overly indulgent to eat that cupcake when someone remarks how much sugar it has. But don't believe the hype. Remind yourself you've worked hard for your improved relationship to food and the freedom that comes with it. Mora also suggests setting firm anti-diet talk boundaries with family before a get-together or event, stopping a conversation in its tracks by putting up a hand. You know that kind of talk doesn't work for me. And repeating positive affirmations to yourself when negative thoughts arise. Ultimately, what stuck with me the most from Moore's suggestions was about honoring my own journey with food and eating and how far I've come. Fight for it. Protect it, Mora says. What if we all were as quick to protect ourselves from the perils of diet culture as we were to protect ourselves from gaining a few pounds or eating carbs? How different the world would look then. For me, being honest with those around me about how comments about food or dieting affect me felt and still feels like the rawest, most vulnerable thing possible. To admit that my relationship with food was flawed, that I was affected by diet talk, that I didn't want to diet at all like they did felt weak, like admitting I had less willpower than they did. Often it still does, But now, when I think about these discussions, I think about more as advice, to push back, to set boundaries, to protect my healthy relationship with food. I also think about something else, something I tell myself often when pushing back against the urge to starve myself or binge feels impossible. I remind myself that dieting is hard work, that believing your body is inherently flawed, that it being 5 or 10 pounds less would make you happy, is exhausting. And pushing back against dieting, believing you are okay and worthy as is, no matter the number on the scale, that's hard work too. Only one of those choices is sustainable though, so I choose the latter. I choose the work that makes me feel worthy now, and I'll keep choosing it. That story was, I quit dieting for good, but escaping diet culture was a whole other factor, by Olivia Munter, posted on November 3rd, 2020. The next story is Wild Rice Dressing. Wild rice, it's actually a seed, has a deeper flavor as well as more protein, fiber, and antioxidants than traditional rice. With grassy, smoky notes, it plays well with fall flavors like the dried cherries, full of potassium and beta-carotene, and pecans. By Anna Theoctisto, Health, November 2020. Prep 1 hour, total 1 hour, servings 8. Ingredients: 1.5 cups uncooked wild rice, 3/4 teaspoon kosher salt, 1/4 cup extra virgin olive oil, 2 large leeks, white and light green parts only, thinly sliced, 2 medium celery stalks, chopped, 1 tablespoon fresh thyme leaves, 1 cup chopped toasted pecans, 1 cup unsweetened dried cherries, 3 tablespoons fresh Meyer lemon juice or 2 tablespoons regular lemon juice, 1/4 teaspoon black pepper. Directions: Step 1. Bring 4 cups water, rice, and 1/4 teaspoon salt to a boil in a large saucepan over high. Reduce heat to low, cover and cook, stirring occasionally until rice is tender, about 40 minutes. Drain. Step 2. Heat oil in a large skillet over medium high. Cook leeks and celery, stirring often until leeks are tender, about 5 minutes. Add thyme, cook, stirring often until fragrant, about 1 minute. Remove from heat. Transfer mixture to a large bowl. Stir in cooked rice, pecans, cherries, lemon juice, pepper, and remaining 1/2 teaspoon salt. Prep ahead. You can cook the wild rice up to 3 days ahead and keep it chilled, covered. Bring to room temperature. That will take about 1 hour before assembling dressing. That story was Wild Rice Dressing by Anna Theoctisto. Health, November 2020, from health.com. That concludes today's readings of Health Magazine. This has been Allison Ramsey for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3. Sunday afternoons, we take you around the Lone Star State for 3 hours, starting at 2 p.m. with Texas Monthly Archives. At 3, it's the current issue of Texas Monthly Magazine. At 4, Travelin' Texas. And at 4:30, Texas Gardener. Sunday afternoons, beginning at 2, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 81 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from today's USA Today, Monday, November 9th, 2020. Starting with the money section, and there's no money line column because it's Monday. So, starting with the first item, fiscal forecast, how Biden's presidency could affect the economy, this bipartisan